The following podcast is sponsored by you. If you'd like to donate to help us continue providing the best VCU men's basketball podcast out there, please use the link in the show notes for this episode. Proceeds from your donations will be used to pay for hosting fees, which are the most expensive ongoing part of providing this show. Thank you in advance, and go Rams! Welcome to Rams Rewind, a podcast that looks back at all of the action from VCU men's basketball. In this special off-season edition, host George Templeton reviews what's been happening since the last time the Rams hit the court. And now, here's George.
Before the storm of next season starts, before we get really rolling in the transfer portal, because surprisingly, as we record this tonight, no VCU players have entered the transfer portal, and they're the only team in the Atlantic 10 that is the case for. Part of that, admittedly, is they were also the last team in the Atlantic 10 to finish the season, so that's certainly sort of that reason, but we'll get into that when we can. But welcome to Rams Rewind, because this is our wrap-up of the 2024 season. First and foremost, if you like what you hear and you want to help us out, you can shoot us some dinero in the PayPal, in the link for the description for the PayPal, because, of course, we will be doing this again next year, so any help you give us is appreciated, like our good friend Timothy Sharp, who sent us something this past week as we were wrapping up the season. Thank you, Timothy, very much for that, and thank you to everybody that has supported us so well all year. We really appreciate you. Now, joining me, After some serious effort to get him on, not of all his fault, by the way, he's being loaded down like Atlas, trying to carry the world here, this young man. But we're very happy to have back with us from the Richmond Times-Dispatch, of course, the parish that I was once part of, the VCU beat writer and deputy sports editor, newly minted, Zach Joaquin. Thank you for joining us, Zach. Welcome back to Rams Rewind.
George, it's always an honor. Thank you so much for having me on, my friend. I'm sorry it took a while for us to pin this down right now, as we were discussing before we started recording here. I'm wading through a quagmire of high school coverage and coordinating between the different Lee properties and everything, and then they had March Madness and everything, and so I'm struggling a little bit at the moment. I'm sorry this took so long for me to come on.
Let's put it this way, folks. They basically tied two anchors to his ankles, threw him into James River, and said, "Swim." That's what's going on here. So
I love me some James River, though.
I absolutely, but not with anchors tied to your ankles. That's a little tough. But he's doing the best he can, and we finally got him on, and we're happy to talk about it. So we're going to talk about this season, and we are going to start at the beginning, because you go back to November and October, November. And even though we all made a very big deal of it at the time, I'm not even sure we knew how much it hurt this team. One, Joe Bamisil being denied a waiver, and two, Sean Bairstow breaking his foot. That was a double whammy that, if I'm not mistaken, came pretty close together as I search my memory now, because those were both right before the exhibition against Mars Hill. Neither gentleman played in that game as a result. And I just wonder if that was sort of the first bad step that led to other bad steps this season.
And Joe ended up being kind of a slow burn, right, where we didn't know what was going on. And so even as the season started, right, it was still – there was a lot of apprehension about what his status was going to be. And then that snowballed into a national conversation, right, with the lawsuits. And all the state attorneys general joining in, and Joe eventually testifying. I mean, I don't think at the beginning of the year we all had any inkling that it was going to get to that point, right? So then the Sean Bairstow injury was obviously terrible timing for Sean, for VCU. And you saw as the season wore on how important those two guys were. It's impossible not to play the what-if game right at the end of the year about what if those Joe had been eligible earlier and Sean had been healthy, and how different could things have looked. And I always think about, I think it was early on in conference play that we talked to Ryan at one of his press conferences in the middle of the week. And it was, I think, when VCU had started to get things going a little bit, right? It was maybe a few games after the win at George Mason that kind of turned things around there in conference play. And we were asking Ryan about getting those two guys back into the fold. And he said, look, when you have major adjustments to your lineup like that, there's a chance sometimes that it can get worse before it gets better. And it did. That's exactly what happened with VCU, right? When you were trying to get two major pieces like that ingratiated into a team that had gotten really used to playing without them, it got worse before it got better. And it certainly got better. And this team found a ceiling, you know, that I think we all knew was there. But that, you know, and I led my last story of the year with this, is that they just didn't capture that ceiling consistently enough to really reach the full potential of what this group was capable of. And not having Joe and Sean for such a large stretch of the season early on was one of the major components of that that you can point to. And, you know, if you have those guys, Norfolk State is the first one that comes to mind, right? Then I think it's pretty, you can definitively say that outcome is different. Orlando certainly looks different. I mean, you had Iowa State on the ropes. You had Boise State on the ropes. Those ended up being both pretty darn good basketball teams. Iowa State ended up being kind of a great basketball team. How good would that have looked on the resume if you'd been able to seal that up, right? I mean, and then Memphis goes to overtime, right? I mean, it's easy to look at some of those close results and how big Joe and Sean were to this team. And maybe it's you know, looking at the hypotheticals with rose-colored glasses. But I think this is an NCAA tournament team, right, if those two guys are there at the beginning of the year. Because looking at the season outcomes, it's only a few results. Right. I think really if you get that Iowa State win, obviously the rest of Orlando looks different. But if you get the Iowa State win and you don't lose to Norfolk State, then this team is absolutely on the bubble, maybe on the right side of the bubble. And then the Bonaventure and George Washington losses at the beginning of conference play. Right. That's the area that it got worse before it got better when you tried to get those two guys back in the fold. And so maybe you don't lose either of those games, you know. And so, yeah, it's really easy to play the what-if game with Joe Bamisil and Sean Bairstow. Thankfully, we get more Joe Bamisil, which is like one of the big silver linings at the end of the year, right, that he definitively said he's coming back. I'm actually going to be – I'll throw in a pitch for a story next week. Joe's going to be at Planet Fitness on Monday because he has an NIL deal with them.
Excellent.
And so I think that's really cool. I'm going to try and talk to Rodney Ashby, you know, and people around the Havoc Collective about the NIL situation for VCU, because that's obviously a huge part of how the transfer portal operates these days. And kids are looking at NIL opportunities at different schools. But Joe, as a local guy, you know, who's staying for his next year and one of the few guys that you're certain is going to be a part of this roster next year at this juncture, it's cool to see him getting those sponsorship opportunities. Right. And he's also talked about how physical fitness has been such a big part of the mental health journey that he's been very public about. And so that's super cool, you know, to see him be able to parlay that into a business opportunity for him. So I'm going to be at Planet Fitness and talk to Joe on Monday. And he's just a really likable guy. Right. So I think everyone is very excited to have a full season of Joe Bamisil when that's not, you know, overshadowed and marred by the eligibility battle. And Sean Bairstow, oof. We could have a fascinating retrospect on his VCU career, right? Which I don't know if you want to jump into that.
We will do that, and I want to talk about Joe Bamisil too, but I want to focus on one particular part of your answer because it's something that came up in the last pod I recorded live in the fan group I'm in, and one of the commenters made a great comment about it. I'm just looking forward to next year, this being a more consistent team, and I think that's sort of the thing that I'm focusing on, is that when we talk about – when I get you to answer this next question, this has to be figured in, because we had a very interesting debate about what we would grade this season on. They could never get really any sort of consistency because they didn't have a consistent lineup. They didn't really have consistent minutes. Some of that I blame on the coach. We'll get to that later. And it was just impossible for them, I think, to really get the sort of consistency they needed, because how could you when this guy's going to be eligible, then he's not. This guy's going to play, and then he's hurt. This guy comes back. That guy comes back. Somebody else gets hurt. Bairstow comes back. He gets hurt again. They couldn't really get ahead of steam up, which, of course – despite that, they had a really good run in the middle of the season, so that's kind of remarkable in a sense. But they really couldn't get ahead of steam up all year because they really didn't have a consistent lineup except at the beginning, really. And of course, I'm gonna focus a little bit on that and get to those other things. But bearing in mind all of that, I gave this team, especially because of how well they did in the NIT, I went from a B to a B-plus for the season. Mm-hmm. If you had to give this season a grade, what would you give it, bearing in mind all of that?
The program as a whole, or Ryan specifically, or the players, or just everyone?
Any direction you want to take that in. I just gave the season a B-plus, but that's kind of interesting because one of the other very good comments I got was, this person was giving them a very nice grade, but said depending on the transfer portal, the grade for the season could actually go down. And I thought that was a pretty smart point.
I think first and foremost, I saw enough to make me confident that Ryan Odom is the guy for this, right? And that this VCU program generally, and that's the most important thing, right? I think that's a consensus around the fan base and around the A-10, right? Is you saw enough from Odom, from the personnel decisions that he made, from the schematic decisions that he made, that sequence at the end of, what was it? Was it South Florida? I think that was brilliant, by the way, when he called the timeout to save the 10-second violation and then drew up that inbounds play to free up Toby.
Yes.
I mean, he's very stoic and calm on the sidelines during games, right? I think it's so interesting to have the foil of Matt Henry next to him because you've got like this fiery, demonstrative guy who's, you know, hands all over the place and yelling. And then Ryan is just very like arms folded a lot of the time and has a very stoic demeanor on the sidelines. I thought that was interesting to observe the whole year. So I saw enough first and foremost from him for me to be confident that this team is headed in the right direction. I think that he was all year trying to feel out how the personnel that he ended up with in a team that was very much thrown together, you know, in a really hectic offseason. He was trying to get them to play his brand of basketball throughout the year to very varying degrees of success, right? You saw Max Scholga and Sean Bairstow, when they were both available, they were playing a ton of minutes. And I think that Ryan was trying to rotate around those two guys who he was comfortable with to execute his style and figure out the right pieces that fit with them. And I think even to the last game of the season, he was really still feeling through that. Because there were guys who were streaky, right? There was a lot of inconsistency. There were guys who showed high ceilings. I think of Kawani, right, who had that really hot shooting stretch where he could not miss. I mean, early on in A-10 play, what was he shooting, 70-something percent?
From three, after being 0 for 16 or 0 for 17 or whatever it was.
And then how did he finish the season, George? Then he couldn't make anything again. You know, yeah,
he ends up under 40%, even though he had that hot streak in the middle.
Yeah, and still ended up at like 39.5, I think, for the season.
38 is what I have listed on from the VCU site, as I have the cumulative stats up. So, yes.
For a 6'9", 200-pound forward, that's great. That's outstanding to shoot from outside like that, right? But it wasn't like the number doesn't tell you the whole story. And I think that's kind of this team, right, is the number maybe – the record, the results don't necessarily tell you the whole story because it was turbulent. You know, you had the Norfolk State loss we've already talked about. That was a really low point. Missed opportunities against Iowa State, against Boise State, against Memphis in the non-conference. You know, obviously how they started with Bonaventure and G-Dub. I mean, God, I remember after that G-Dub game, and I wrote about it in the game story. I have not felt a more depressed atmosphere in the Siegel Center.
That's easily the nadir for me.
It was rainy that day.
That's a low point, and it's not close. That was you're getting into the lower circles of hell with that particular loss.
How in the world did James Bishop hit that shot? What the hell was that? I still don't know how James Bishop hit that shot.
We're going to get into the issues here because that particular game and a few other particular games and how the minutes were distributed is going to be a main gripe, but I don't want to get ahead of ourselves.
We could have a whole podcast about Fats Billups season, which I'm sure we'll touch on.
And we must spend some time on that because, again, I've got a few main gripes. That's one of them.
B-plus, to answer your question. I think I agree. B-plus fell just short of where they wanted to be, right? I mean, you were one win away from the NCAA tournament. You had a great run at the A-10 tournament where they really flipped the script against UMass. That was a feel-good win after what happened in Amherst, right? Mm-hmm. Villanova didn't really want to be playing basketball in that first game of the NIT, right? I mean, that was an impressive win to go there against, a top 20 defensive team in the country and play as well as they did offensively against them. But Villanova clearly did not want to be playing basketball. I don't know how much longer Neptune is going to be the coach there. They've had a couple of down years. South Florida, on the other hand, really wanted to be playing basketball. They were up for that game.
Yes, they did.
You can speak to that better than I can. That environment seemed awesome from TV. So that was a fantastic
game. It was as good an environment as I've been in. The only thing I would say was better than that was a rather famous CAA final between ODU and VCU at the Coliseum, which was completely sold out, 11,000.
Was that 2011?
Not 2011. This was Alex Loughton ate us up in the overtime. We had Bo Jones was playing then, and VCU made a big comeback and got it to overtime, and Alex Loughton just simply wouldn't let us freaking win. I think that was – I want to say that was – oh gosh, I wish I could remember now, but it was not 2011. It was definitely not 2011 because we didn't get into the tournament. But that was I actually got to sit in the stands for that one in the lower part of the Coliseum, and that's the best college basketball atmosphere I've ever been in by, at least until the South Florida game. It was by that far.
Does that sound right that they did lose to ODU in that 2011 CAA final? Though I remember, so the Gerald Lee ODU days was my kind of
Gerald Lee.
My first VCU games, I was wearing silver and navy face paint. And traveling up 64, and I was the enemy there. But Gerald Lee, Darius James, those are the ODU players that I Kent Bazemore, which is wild that he went on and had the career that he did. Finney, right? Ben Finney. Those are the ODU teams that I remember. And I was at an ODU VCU CAA final at the Coliseum, and it was outstanding. But to get back to South Florida, looked great. This team beat some really good basketball teams over the course of the year, right? Dayton. Won an NCAA tournament game. It was really good all year, and they beat them at the Siegel Center, and then they gave them hell at UD Arena.
Should have won at UD Arena, right?
And so showed a high ceiling, also showed a low floor, and was inconsistent, and didn't find the high ceiling consistently enough, and didn't avoid the low floor consistently enough, right? And that's why they kind of fell a step short of where you wanted them to be. But overall, given all of the moving parts that were thrown at Ryan and all of these kids trying to learn a new system, and come into a new program and, only four returners, five including Obi, from last year. I definitely don't think you can say it's any kind of roaring failure. They won 24 games and they got
Wins with all the upheaval and four players coming back from last year's roster and a new coach and everything else that was going on is pretty darn good, let's be honest. I want to go back to Orlando just to say this. Absolutely heroic efforts against Iowa State. They should have won. We all know what happened. Shulga missing that layup near the end. They couldn't stop the two guards driving, whatever. They kind of ran out of gas. Even that's what Rodney Ashby said to me about Boise State, which is – which was right, but it also, again, points to one of the things I'm going to complain about. But they win the Penn State game, and Billups, of course, has a great game. And Michael Bell, I think, has an excellent game, even though he plays 37 minutes, which is a lot. But I feel like that we came out of that situation with the wrong lesson, because once Bairstow and Bamisil became eligible – instead of playing consistently 9 and 10 players a game and rationing out the minutes as such and using our depth to overwhelm them, it felt like Coach Odom stuck with the rotation. And to me, that was a problem all season long, especially when we get to the conference final, which we'll spend a few minutes on when we get to it.
Yeah, and you see flashes at the end of the year from Fats and Bell. Right. And Ryan talking about in the NIT, I wanted them to get postseason minutes, which was great. But it kind of made you a little, some hindsight bias about what could have been with those guys if you didn't cut their minutes so much. It fluctuated a ton. Right. Like Bell started playing more when this team figured things out defensively, starting with that George Mason win. Vats had the Penn State game, which was outstanding. Right. I mean, they had some really noticeable highs for freshmen. But you almost feel like their growth was stunted a little bit over the course of the season by how much their minutes fluctuated. And in Ryan's defense, that's hard when you're trying to introduce guys like Joe and Sean, who are experienced players and who expect to play big minutes when they come in, right? I mean, that he had a lot of moving pieces to manage, and you know, was it perfect? No, but did he get dealt a tough hand? Hell yeah, he did. It was not an easy hand from a coaching perspective to try and mold all of those pieces together. And I mean, I think Ryan did the best he could, but it is, you're right, it's certainly easy to look back at how the minutes were divvied out and say, could you have tried to make this a little more consistent, you know, and kept guys like Fats and Bell on a more set minutes pace rather than, you know, it felt like Bell might play 20 plus minutes, you know, on this night and make some really good defensive contributions, and then he plays less than 2 minutes, you know, the next week or something like that.
And we'll get to that, but you've now hit on the point. Sean Bairstow's coming off breaking his foot, and he plays 33 minutes a game, and he shoots under 40% from the season, barely. Struggles from three, doesn't take a lot of them, to be fair. You know, the Sean Bairstow I saw on highlight videos, and I know you can't get too taken with those. The Sean Bairstow that was so dynamic, driving the basket with menace, finishing at the rim with menace, making all these wonderful passes. We didn't get that, and I'm not sure we could have ever got it coming off the broken foot. So, you know, maybe we can give Ryan Odom a little bit of a pass on that. But he averaged 33 minutes a game coming off a broken foot, and I don't think he was as effective as a result.
We got flashes of it, right? I mean, 12 assists against LaSalle.
Oh, that was his best game, right? Except for maybe South Florida. That was his best game of the year.
That was wonderful. And he had a few dunks, you know, a few moments, right, where you saw the athleticism and the explosiveness and, you know, some games where he was able to penetrate consistently. And I think some of this team's best offense came off of when he got into that space in the lane that he loved to occupy so much, when he had a smaller guy on the perimeter on him. And he said, I'm going to back this guy down. I'm going to take it into the lane. And then you got the dump off to Firm, a lob to Toby. He was really good in the two-man game with those two guys, and some of Firm and Toby's best offensive sequences of the year, I think, was off that two-man game with Sean and him being able to feed them rolling toward the basket. But you're right. I mean, where is it? I got the numbers here. He started 24 of 25 games in which he appeared. He averaged 10 points, 4.7 rebounds, 3.7 assists over 33 minutes. That's pretty good on surface level, right? But you're left with a painful what if as it pertains to the fractured foot and the chest injury. He missed 13 games. The chest injury, I think, maybe is it's easy to look at the fractured foot early in the season because that was such a big part of the narrative early in BCU season. But then to have another injury kind of midway through conference play when you're really just getting back into the rhythm of things, I think that was really unfortunate in terms of everyone else feeling comfortable, you know, with playing around Sean, because you'd miss so much of him early in the year. And then you get another sequence where Sean's out for a little bit and then Zeb misses those few games. And to have those key pieces in and out, man, I mean, so many teams around the country deal with injuries. You know, Iowa State was missing Hassan Ward for that game against VCU, right? And so everyone has that narrative that they can point to, but especially when you've got a new coach and when you've got so many new pieces, to have key guys like that in and out is really hard to find consistency. And at the end of the day, you know, Sean's season is kind of example A of why this VCU team struggled to find consistency, I think.
And I just felt watching him that he did not have the confidence in his own body.
And not in that three-point shot.
Problem.
Yeah, for sure. The numbers at Utah State, we all thought this guy was going to be a pretty good three-point shooter, right? And he tried to put more of him up toward the end of the year, but it got to the point where defenders were really sagging off of him, man. And he was not getting the same penetration later in the year because nobody was respecting the outside shot.
Well, let's go to that. Let's go, because we talked about it a lot. We're going to go to it now. The absolute nadir of the season was George Washington. You know, they had played pretty badly against St. Bonaventure. There was never a point in that game where you thought they were going to win. St. Bonaventure sets the record for the most points by an opponent in the Siegel Center. And none of us saw the GW game coming, honestly. And there's a lot of reasons why this is the nadir. I suppose the one good thing that came out of it is that the coach realized that Michael Bell needed to play because, and this is, you know, this is one of those things that we've sort of talked about already, Michael Bell's, you know, minutes that were so large early in the season and he plays well. Then as we get to the end of the of non-conference season. He plays 11 minutes against Maryland Eastern Shore. He plays 4 minutes against Gardner-Webb. He plays 1 minute versus St. Bonaventure. He plays 3 minutes against George Washington. They are a terrible defensive team. I ranted and raved plenty about it at this point. I was pretty unhappy with it. So there, if there was a good thing that came out of GW, it's that changed. But unfortunately, besides losing that game, there was another very bad circumstance that came out of that game. And that's what happened to Fats Phillips' minutes. Now, of course, some of this was he got the technical foul, which ended up being critical in a two-point loss. But from that point, and remember, Fats Phillips had played double-digit minutes almost every game except for Iowa State and except for St. Bonaventure. When he got in the game, he was getting time on the floor. And, of course, famously at Penn State, he got 27 minutes and had all those points against Penn State. After the GW game, he got double-digit minutes twice until the NIT, which is something that is problem one for me. Now, I don't know if that was to do with the technical foul or the fact that Bamisil and Bairstow had just come back. It could be all of those things. But that strikes me as the worst coaching move that Ryan Odom made this year by far. The lack of minutes for Fats Phillips from the GW game on.
I think it seems that Ryan identified just general maturity, I guess. I mean, Fats is an outstanding kid, by the way. But yeah, the technical was not great. And obviously in a two-point loss, that sticks out. And he missed some defensive assignments. I think that he looked like a freshman in some moments there, right? I mean, I'm looking at the box scores here, and you're absolutely right. He played in that G-Dub loss. Fats played 19 minutes. He scored 10 points. He was 4 of 6 from the field, 2 of 4 from 3, which is great, right? And Michael Bell played 3 minutes in that game and did not score. And then in the win at Mason, Fats did not play. He did not see the floor at all. And then and Michael Bell played 21 minutes, right? And was really good defensively in that game. So something clearly flipped for Ryan and how he saw those guys' roles. Michael Bell playing more was a big part of this team's defensive turnaround for sure. And so from that standpoint, I mean, I think it looks like a correct coaching move on surface level, right? But with the ceiling that we saw from Fats in those moments, I'm with you. I mean, people on Twitter all season were screaming free Fats, right? And I also think from a coach's perspective, I'm sure Ryan understands this. You've got to understand what a hometown kid means, and a kid who's already stayed through one coaching transition. A kid that the Richmond area loves to death, and the fact that they do not want to see him leave. People would be heartbroken to see Fats Phillips enter the transfer portal. We'll get to that soon about what it looks like the future holds right now. But yeah, man, he made such big contributions in that Penn State game and looked so good offensively in moments. But I do think there were some breakdowns defensively that Ryan identified and maybe some freshman moments like the technical, that earned Fats that time on the bench. But you're right. In hindsight, it's easy to say you would love some more consistency there rather than one guy playing 20 plus minutes one game and then not seeing the floor the next. And then you flip-flopping like that. You would have loved to see if you could carve out more consistent roles for those two guys. Imagine if you could combine Michael Bell and Fats Phillips into one player, bro. Oh, they'd be an All-American. They would have been an All-American.
And again, for anybody that's listening to this and thinks I'm Monday morning quarterbacking, you can go back through my podcasts. This was a regular complaint of mine. And, of course, from my perspective, I wasn't talking – it's not either or with the two of them. It's – I don't want Bamisil, Shulga, Bairstow playing the minutes they played. And my final point is this. This young man, Fats Phillips, didn't get the time in key moments that I felt he needed to get. He shot almost 44% from the field, only slightly worse than Kawani, who had the hot streak that we mentioned, only slightly worse than Max Shulga, the team's leading scorer. Better from the field than Joe Bamisil, I might add. And I'll add this. You throw out Toby Lawal because he only took 7 threes. Only two guys shot 40% from three on this team this year. One of them is Max Scholga, no surprise. The other was Fats Billups. And that is one of the many reasons why I'm pretty frustrated, because there were games, and we're about to talk about one in a few minutes, where he needed to be out there because we needed that specifically.
Oh, did you see my halftime tweet during the A-10 final? That was leading into that second half. I took Fats was warming up right in front of me. I took a picture of him, and I was like, is this guy the spark that VCU needs in that second half? Because in a rugged, physical, mud wrestling game, as Keith Dambrock called it, yeah, I really felt like that was the guy that could have been that spark in the second half. And just because Joe couldn't get it, you know, Joe and Max couldn't really get it going that day. And Fats is the next guy that, you know, is that kind of offensive spark that he can catch fire. And he obviously showed that in the Penn State game. I don't know if there's any, if it's worth throwing out the congruencies here between the Penn State game was on a Sunday. Yes. It was at the end of Orlando, yes. Right? Duquesne was on a Sunday. It was at the end of a tournament. That probably doesn't mean anything, but it just felt like in that moment, like he could have done, you know, not what he did against Penn State, but could have maybe been the difference in that game, which ended up a 6-point game, but it was down to one at one point in that second half, right? What was it, 49-48? I mean, VCU was right there with an A-10 championship in their grasp, and it felt like Fats could have impacted that game. I'm with you, and that's not the only game that it felt like Fats could have impacted positively.
Oh, no, that's, you know, I mean, one thing that we do have to remember, too, he was actually started. He was about the only thing that was going to get this team rolling in the UMass game, mm-hmm. And then he turned his ankle, which was very frustrating because I do think that could have made a big difference. That might have been the one thing that could have got us back in the game at UMass was Fats going, you know, going nuclear. But you brought it up, and you already started to talk about it, and I go to that damn game against Duquesne because they got down 18 – in the first half, mainly because at least in the first half, they could not guard Clark and Grant, but everybody was getting off on them. Mahorichich, Fusini, Drame, all these guys, they were absolutely killing them in the first half. And it was just it was brutal to watch. It was absolutely brutal to watch. And you go into that game and you end up in that game with Michael Bell playing, I think almost no time in the second half. He played 4 minutes in the first half. I think he got in for 14 seconds in the second half.
He finished with 4 minutes. Yeah.
Fats Billups played none. And again, you're going to say this is people are going to that haven't listened all year are going to say this is Monday morning quarterbacking. But I said it after the Villanova game, and you look at the NIT run and how the minutes were. If Ryan Odom had played the final against Duquesne like he played the NIT run there in the NCAA tournament, I have no doubt about it.
He went to pretty much a 7-man rotation, right? Which for a team that we talked about, the bench, I mean, they led the A-10 in bench points all year, right? Joe was such a big part of that. But for a team that felt like it had the depth to wear other teams out that didn't have that same depth, and you would think on a Sunday, it's your fourth game in 5 days, right, that would have been something that the perfect scenario for you to try and utilize that depth. And Duquesne playing the same thing, they had to be exhausted at that point. Both teams looked exhausted throughout that game, frankly. And you still, right, I'm looking at the box score, right?
Duquesne, I mean, was on fumes in the second half.
Jason Nelson played 3 minutes. Michael Bell played, yes, four. And aside, yes, from that, it was Jackson, Kawani, Scholga, Bairstow, Furman, Bamisil on the wall. I mean, he really shortened it to a pretty strict 7-man rotation. And for a team that had this type of depth, I'm with you. That feels like a missed opportunity.
And then, and here's one of the other things we've got to talk about, because we talked about Joe Bamisil, and we're going to spend some more time on Fats because we're going to talk about the portal in a minute. Joe Bamisil, really, until the NIT, kind of struggled when he wasn't playing in the Siegel Center. He had some good games on the road against some bad teams.
St. Louis, yeah.
St. Louis in particular. But against anybody good on the road until the NIT, it wasn't great. And unfortunately, he was the big culprit at the end, the big bucket by D. McKelley. He really struggled on defense. How much do you think he's going to work? How much can he work on that? How can they make him at least a passable defender out there, because he had a green light over him, and a lot of teams took advantage of him. And I saw a lot of efforts that were poor efforts, especially coming around screens and fighting through screens. He would be a step behind way too many times. I'm glad Joe Bama still's back, because he is a dynamic scorer. He is a great personality. He is a leader. He is a winner. Don't misunderstand this criticism I have from him. And he's going to be a valuable member of this team next season. There can be no doubt about that. But he has got to be a better defender than what he was this year. And when you watched that last that key basket at the end of the Duquesne game, and Toby Lawall has got Jimmy Clark covered. I think it's Jimmy Clark. And for whatever reason, he just decides to help, and he doesn't really do anything, and he leaves D. Mikel open for the big basket. That's the kind of stuff that has got to be tightened up. You can't have that next season when we hope to be playing for similar type accolades.
It was weird, right? Because overall, I don't think Joe was the defensive liability on a consistent basis that people feared he would be. But he had breakdowns in key moments, right? And so that's the example of it, right? Where a rotation that he didn't get to fast enough would hurt you when it mattered most. In that game, I mean, it's worth saying, Joe scored 20 points, which was a game high. I mean, he was the only one who could get anything going offensively for VCU. He also had 3 blocks and 2 steals in that game against Duquesne. So he was good defensively, I thought, in that game. It was just he had a breakdown in a bad moment, like you pointed to. And I think that was kind of the narrative for him, is that he knew, you know, Joe's aware of the narrative going into the season, right? That he's obviously a bucket and a half and can get a basket whenever he needs to. But the defensive end was the worry. I mean, that was the case at G-Dub, you know, years ago when he had that season there. And I imagine that's part of what kept him off the floor at Oklahoma. But it really, overall, I thought the defensive intensity was good. He wanted to prove people wrong and play on that end. The want to, I thought, was there. It was just there were some key breakdowns on rotations in bad moments. And exactly, I think that Duquesne game is easy to point to at the end. That obviously killed them. I mean, it was right, we said 49-48. I think they were right there in that game. And then just in that waning, in the sequence, in the waning moments of the game, they couldn't find a bucket when they needed to, and they had a couple of bad defensive breakdowns. So I don't think Joe is a defensive liability, though. I think that was perhaps a little overblown throughout the season. I think it popped up in bad moments where it was noticeable, but I was generally impressed by his defensive intensity. I thought that he clearly kind of took that to heart, and the want to was really there for him on the defensive end. And he's a good enough scorer that, I mean, I don't need him to be a lockdown defender, right? He was such an offensive spark plug for this team, and he's got such a high ceiling in his offensive game that, you know, I don't need you to be a real stopper. I just need you to be serviceable on that end. And I thought he was serviceable for the most part throughout the year. I thought the want to and the defensive intensity was definitely there for him to garner the minutes that he did, especially what you got from an offensive output standpoint, because especially in that game, he was the only one who could get anything going. And in moments, I thought that he had one of my favorite quotes of the season, right? When people asked him about in one of those press conferences about his mindset with the scoring.
I think I know where you're going with this.
When I had the ball and I was open, I shot it. And then sometimes when I had the ball and I wasn't open, I shot it. I love that so much. And that's Joe Bama still for you, isn't it?
I mean, my only criticism on offense is because he's such a three, he's such a great offensive player, and he's a three-level scorer. So mid-range, at the rim, three-point line. And to me, it's just I want him to balance it out a little bit because, again, you think about that Duquesne game, as good as he was 0 for 8 from 3. Granted, one of those shots he made he thought was a 3, and they called a 3 and changed it. So that's a little whatever. But Joe Bamisil, again, one of the most dynamic scorers we've had for quite a while. I want him to be a little more selective from outside because he can drive on people. He can get to the rim. And at times it finished brilliantly at the rim, you know, even with a few dunks here and there. That's my only criticism on that. before we get to the tough part, which is the portal and what may or may not happen, I'm going to break in and say this. I just, as we were recording, Seton Hall just survived a flurry of shots by Indiana State at the end to win the NIT. So let's put some smiles on people's faces and talk about the NIT run, because let's face it, it was sensational. And I don't use that word lightly, but it was. To go on the road and beat a Power 5 team, whatever their motivations were, so what? I don't care that the crowd was dead and this and that, because quite frankly, VCU couldn't win it with a dead crowd all year until they won that game. And then at South Florida, they won with one of the best atmospheres I've been in for a long time, and it was absolutely crazy, against the regular season champions of the American Conference, and they went there and won. The efforts that they put in, the hustle that they showed, I mean, they absolutely poured them the entirety of themselves in those first two games. And it's all, and even though I don't love the excuse of, oh, they were tired in the travel for Utah, a week later, or a week and a half later, we can look at that and say they emptied the chamber twice.
Yeah.
And you can only empty the chamber but so many times before you got nothing left. But let's just your thoughts on those two wins. Again, I say it, they're sensational. They're two of the best road wins this team has had for a long time.
At the A-10 tournament before the UMass game, there was a video that I tweeted out that I'm sure a lot of people saw that day. I was there, it was during the Richmond-St. Joseph's game, and I was in the media room, and I heard the bunch of yelling in the tunnel outside, and I thought I recognized some of the voices, so I went out and investigated, and it was them warming up in the tunnel under Barclays Center. And there was just kind of an infectious attitude that morning that I thought really carried over into that UMass game, and I think that that was what they showed up to the NIT with, because I think this was a team that felt the pressure of high expectations at VCU at times this year, right? And that pressed sometimes, and that pressed in that Duquesne game when they really started to feel it. And what you saw in the NIT game was a kind of F it, we ball attitude that I thought really suited this group, right? Which the pressure was off their shoulders. We're in the NIT. If we lose, so be it. And they played some of their best basketball of the season in those games. And I'm with you. I mean, the atmosphere certainly left a lot to be desired at Nova, but that's a really good defensive team. Like I said, I think they were top 20 nationally defensively. And so to hang 70 points on them in their arena is impressive. Joe had 17 in that game. The scoring was really spread, right? I mean, Max, man, we could talk about this for a while. Since Max had that game in the A-10 semifinal against St. Joseph's, when he was 10 of 11, he just lost it the rest of the
injured.
Year.
He
from
was
an
injured.
Offensive standpoint, he just was not feeling it. As a guy that he missed so many open looks that we saw him knock down consistently all year.
100% he was injured.
Yeah.
100%. I don't care what anybody says. There was something that shoulder that he's had issues with.
Yeah.
I am 100% convinced he was injured, which again kind of frustrates me that he was still out there, because if he was injured, he probably shouldn't have been, but that's another story for another time. But that's my explanation for what happened with Max Shulga after the UMass game.
Something did not look right with him that since that St. Joseph's game and the rest of the year. But against Nova, right? Zeb had 8, Kawani had 8, Fats had 9. That was another game, right, where he made 3 threes. That was another game that he immediately showed that offensive spark. Toby had 8 points, 10 rebounds. Bell had 6 and had some really good minutes, right? He played 17 minutes in that game. Jason Nelson, I don't know, he only played 6 minutes that game. We could talk about Jason. Something happened for him confidence-wise late in the year, and I hate to say it, but everyone has pointed to, it seemed to start at Richmond.
Yes.
Yes, and I don't know, Jason is a great kid. I love that family. Mm-hmm. I don't know if, his production tailed off toward the end of the year.
No, and he's one of the only guys they had that was a dog on defense that would to take the mm-hmm. challenge. Yeah, he was undersized, and sometimes he couldn't overcome that. But it wasn't for lack of trying.
No,
and yeah,
those chase down steals that he had. Those were some of my favorite defensive moments of the year, when he was tracking back and
he
would have the poke from behind to get a steal, and those were really big momentum plays. I love those, and he was the reason they won the Dayton game at the Siegel Center. Anthony Grant said that. I thought he was a difference in the game. Those were Anthony Grant's words.
Yeah, whatever happened, whatever caused whatever happened in his mind after getting booed lustily. And for the moment, folks, let me just make this editorial comment. Any VCU player that went the other way to Richmond would get the same treatment. So don't moralize about the Richmond fans booing. That's what they're supposed to do. And they're supposed to boo him every time he touches it and boo him lustily. Because and if VCU fans had a player that went from VCU to Richmond and didn't do it, I'd want all of you to turn your fan cards in and never come back to the Siegel Center. Do you get me? So enough of that. You know, anybody that was mad about that and said, oh, that's classless, that's baloney. But whatever happened, I hope he goes in the lab, finds his fortress of solitude, and comes back stronger next year, because he is a very good player for us. Mm-hmm. And on defense, he gets after it, and we need that.
The one thing I'll say is I think from a optics standpoint, it was maybe a bad look because Jason's a hometown kid. And I totally understand, right, going to the other side of the rivalry, and I'm with you. But I guess maybe there could have been a little more awareness just from the Richmond fans, you want to recruit hometown kids, you know, you went to Verina and John Marshall, got a lot of ties locally, just maybe a bad idea to not the kid that you want to boo for optics sake. But I'm with you. I understand the inherent fandom of it. And one way or the other, after that point, it did seem like Jason's production tailed off. He was so good in the catch and shoot for large portions of the year, right? I mean, he was one of this team's best, most consistent outside shooters. I think he was hovering around 40% for a while there.
The kick out passes. He was when they would kick it out from the inside to him. And I'd say the same thing about Bamisil. I'd say that about both of them, is that it felt like if they got a pass kicked out from the paint area, it felt like they never missed a three, honestly.
It's automatic, exactly. And that's a good point with both of them, and with Joe that we alluded to earlier. He did force some up off the dribble. And when you're a scorer like that your team is looking to create offense, I think that's natural to an extent. But I'm with you. I'd like to see him drive more and attack more in some of those instances rather than forcing it up off the dribble, because he was lethal in the catch and shoot. And when you can collapse the defense and get the three more in the rhythm of the offense is when he really shot a high percentage. And that number would look better if some of those weren't forced up off the dribble. And it's true for both of them. But that's also just, you know, when you're a guy like Joe that, you know, you have to play ISO sometimes and your team is just looking for you to get a bucket, then you're going to have to force up some shots off the dribble. And that's going to hurt the percentage sometimes. But yeah, I mean, I think we went on a tangent there. I'm sorry. We were talking about the Nova game. That was a great win. And then, man, South Florida, right? That was such a fun basketball game. You can attest to it better than I can. I wasn't there, but man, that looked awesome. And you could hear it on TV. That atmosphere was outstanding.
My only disappointment is that being Sunday night at 7:30, I honestly think if that thing had been Saturday night or Sunday afternoon at like 3 or 4 o'clock, I think they could have sold it out. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, I didn't see what the attendance was, but up to the very, very top of that place, it was flipping full, and it was a great atmosphere. And again, to come up with that performance, 60. Okay, it was actually less than I thought. I thought
3,398. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought they got to 7,000. They did not. I honestly think they could have either sold it out or come very close if that had been either Sunday afternoon or Saturday night, you know, when people wouldn't have had to work tomorrow. And that was – it was – I mean, you could see it. They wouldn't let us in until 90 minutes before the game, which was kind of unusual. But the people were lined up. 2 hours, you know, this is 2 hours before tip-off. Students are lined up. Fans are lined up at every gate. You know, and I'm like, oh man, this is gonna be something else. And I mean, one of the main student sections was full already. Like, it was full by the time I got to my seat on Media Row. It was full after I went, you know, checked in, got the credential, and all that stuff. And for VCU to persevere in that, to maintain their composure in the middle of that, again, sensational. That's all. That's the best word I can use to describe it.
I think Ryan said this could have been an 8-9 game in the NCAA tournament, and it had that feel to it, right? Two teams that were certainly capable of being in the NCAA tournament. Youngblood was outstanding for them. Goodness me, is that kid tough. He's a big physical guard, and he killed him. Much admiration for his game.
Oh, I mean, you just – and actually, but the key play of the game is Zeb, who's our other really good defender, and we haven't talked to any about that, but, you know, low-key, one of the better defenders in the A-10, probably a little unlucky not to be on the
I voted him first. I voted him to the all-defensive team in the preseason, and yeah, I think he was a little unlucky not to be on there.
He
fought
through a screen and got Youngblood to miss the only shot he missed in the second half, which was the three at the end to tie it up. I loved Robbie Robinson's call. It's like, if that went in, you'd have to scrape me off the floor. you'd have had to do likewise to me too, because when he threw it up, I'm like, just this one time, please don't go in. And it didn't. And that was a magnificent effort by Zeb on defense.
How about Zeb? Let's talk about him a bit at the end of the year. He started shooting it with more confidence from outside, right? And he was 4 of 7 from three in that game, ended up with 14 points. And just the all-around game shined all year. Like, he was a good rebounder for a guard, a fantastic perimeter defender. But he started to shoot with more confidence toward the end of the year, and that changes things so much for him, because defenders are so scared of his quickness. He's one of the quickest guys off the dribble that I've ever covered. And for much of the year, defenders were daring him to shoot it from outside, and I think Zeb felt kind of forced into a lot of threes where it's like, I'm open, I need to shoot this. This isn't really in the flow of the offense, but my guy's playing so far off of me that I need to put this up. And so he didn't shoot a great percentage from outside. And then at the end of the year, I don't know if someone talked to him. I want to say we asked Ryan about this, and he said, you know, that they did talk to Zeb and about shooting with more confidence and, you know, trusting his outside shot. And, man, if he can carry that over into next year, and if he is back with VCU, which I think at this juncture it looks increasingly likely that he is, right? Because, no, we haven't heard anything yet about him leaving, and we'll get into that here in a second, but – first of all, what an outstanding kid. One of my favorite players that I've ever interviewed. Just a class act human being that obviously means a lot to this program after he stuck with it and was kind of, you know, one of the cornerstone leaders of this program in the transition from Rhodes to Odom. And man, if he can continue that consistency and that confidence from outside, and it seemed like he kind of just accepted what he was good at and played with more confidence toward the end of the year. Would love to see him, you know, stick it out and finish his career at VCU and carry that over into next year. Because if so, I think he can be an all-conference guard.
Oh, no question about it. And I just want to say, Zeb off the bounce, there aren't many guards that can stay in front of him.
No, so, in the country. He's so quick.
And again, the frustration with Zeb was – he'd make those great drives and then not finish at the rim.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing he's got to work on. He needs to work on the three-point shooting too, obviously, for obvious reasons. Because, again, if you can be a two- or three-level scorer, you become unstoppable. Hey, look at Joe Bamisil for an example of this. But as good as he was at getting by his defender and to the rack and sometimes kicking the ball out and getting some great assists, he's got to finish these shots at the rim, because that was the killer Memphis – other games so many times, and even in the game, and it happened in one of the key points in the Utah game. You know, he gets to the rim and misses a shot that somebody as good as him has got to make every time, and it ends up in a fast break and a three the other end, and that was just about it for us, unfortunately, in that
Memphis game. Right at the end,
he's got to get better at finishing through contact and finishing at the rim.
At the end of regulation in Memphis, right? Yeah. He had a layup to win that game. And I
think he got clowned on Twitter by some pretty big accounts for not hitting it. I hate to say it.
The thing I'll say in Zeb's defense is I think part of that is because he's so quick. And a lot of the time when he gets going downhill toward the rim, he's moving at such a high speed that the body control is really difficult, right? And so I think that would be later in the year, he kind of fell in love with that really sharp pivot and stop on a dime and that little turn and scoop. I think he hit a few of those toward the end of the year that he wasn't using that move earlier in the year. And I think that was probably him working with Darius, you know, and with other assistants about, all right, how can I control my body a little better when I get to the rim? Because I'm so fast to beat my guy off the dribble, but then I get going at 110 miles an hour and I can't finish at the rim because I'm moving so fast and the body control is difficult. So I think he started to get more comfortable with some of those hesitation moves, being able to, you know, stop on a dime and maybe use a jump stop to slow himself a little more at the rim so that he can finish off glass. I think that's kind of one of the next big steps.
And Joe Bamisil can show him this, because Joe Bamisil had that little stop and a little 4 or 5 foot jumper, and he didn't use it enough for my liking. But he was really good with that move, and Joe can help him with that. I think Joe Bama still can actually help him with that if he sticks around Zeb. But yeah, Zeb is an all is just about an all defense, all for all conference defensive type player, and he's turning into an all conference player if he comes back. So we're just going to gloss over Utah because I really don't want to talk about
Seattle. Yeah, I don't really want to talk about that either, man. I'm glad I was up in arms initially about the fact that I couldn't go cover that in hindsight. Very glad I did not get sent to go cover that because that would have been a long, bad trip back across the country.
The NIT run was great, but that was not a fun ending. And like I say, I've mentioned it enough, and we're not going to mention it anymore. So,
how good are Smith and Carlson? I will throw that out there. They were fun to watch that game. Two really good players. Carlson, what an incredible offensive skill set for a 7-footer. And Smith with the triple-double, that kid did a little bit of everything. They were fun to watch that night.
I wasn't really feeling like appreciating that. Yes, you're right about those things. I wasn't feeling like appreciating that night because that was tough to watch. Okay, so let's move that aside, and now we're going to get to the part that I was certainly dreading at the end of the season, but it is strange that as we sit here, we don't have anybody in the portal yet. Again, as I said at the top of the show, some of that is we were the last team to finish, so that's sort of understandable. And guys are thinking things over. And for example, you know, one of our players, Max Scholga, is absolutely going to test the draft waters. And he should, by the way. And he should, because he's got some skills. He's got good size to play in the backcourt in the pros, whether it's the NBA or Europe or G League or whatever. But how are we feeling as we are heading into this transfer portal? As of now, I think we have three open spots, maybe four. And there are some good players. And let me shout out my co-admin of the fan group with his Portal Combat post. VCU has cast their net wide. Even last year when they needed more players, it felt like the net wasn't cast as wide as it is this year. So, you know, what have you seen or heard so far? What are you thinking as we head into this offseason? What kind of turnover are we looking at here?
It was an incredibly wide net at first, right, which was striking, and it was before VCU even finished playing that they started popping up. And I haven't had a chance to ask Ryan about that yet, but I want to ask him about that. Like, how wild is that to manage when you're still playing basketball games? I saw NC State landed a pretty big transfer today. They're in the Final Four. Like, how wild is that? I mean, the goal in getting good transfers is to get there, and you're there, and you're still, you know, playing all the portal combat, which is nuts. It's a wild, wild west. I made a list. This is not everyone, but I put this into a transfer portal update story last week. St. Mary's sophomore forward Joshua Jefferson, who would be a great get. I think that was the best name out there, I want to say, that was linked to them. He had a great season for them last year. He's a really talented forward. California sophomore forward Grant Newell, San Diego junior guard Wayne McKinney, Loyola Marymount senior guard Justin Wright, he's a grad transfer, Hofstra junior guard Jaquan Carlos. I've seen some people really excited about his game. I think Matt Shelton-Ide really likes him. So he's one that some people were really intrigued by. Jameer Brickus, who everyone will know that name from LaSalle, he's a grad transfer. He'd be a really interesting get. I like his game.
And he'd be immediately, and I mean, I guess everybody would be immediately eligible, but in case somehow that case is adjudicated and the rule comes back, Jameer Brickus would be immediately eligible no matter what.
Colorado senior wing Luke O'Brien, Texas A&M Commerce sophomore forward Jerome Brewer, Wyoming senior wing Brendan Wenzel, and Northern Illinois sophomore forward Xavier Amos. Those are the ones that I'd written down. I don't think that's everyone. I think it's 20-something at this point. Who is it? Ellison Orcutt. That Twitter account does some awesome stuff with the player ratings throughout the year, I want to say. Or it was the Todd VCU. Big shout out to the AI stuff that account does, by the way. I love that. That's some of the best.
I'm looking at our Portal Combat and our fan group, and I'm thinking it's looking like about 23 names, which again is just – and it's sea to shining sea. We've got Mount St. Mary's on this coast, and we've got St. Mary's on the other coast, and everybody in between. I do want to ask about one player – that certainly caught my interest when his name popped up there, and that would be the Mideastern Athletic Conference Player of the Year, Jamari Thomas from Norfolk State. He is He is one heck of a player. When you think about Norfolk State and the fact that they lost a conference player of the year in Joe Bryant and essentially replaced him with this kid, that would be something if VCU got their hands on a guy like that.
He killed them at the Siegel Center.
Yes.
I forget exactly what he had in that game, but 16.9 points per game for the year, 3.8 rebounds, 3.8 assists, 40% from the field. I mean, tough-nosed guard, right? Looks like nothing can rattle him. Seemed like a really strong defensive player to me. I'm not sure what the defensive metrics are on him, but yeah, that would be an outstanding get. I think he's got 2 years of eligibility left, I want to say. It's getting weird with the COVID years because we're getting to the end of that now. And it's tough sometimes. I don't know. That would be a great get. Would be very cool for me. I'm obviously a Norfolk guy. My mom still teaches at ODU. And I went to Maury High School down there.
So. Jabari Thomas, by the way, 17 points, 5 assists, 3 steals in that game at the Siegel Center.
Yep. That sounds right. Comically enough, that was one of the hardest press conferences of my life after that game. So I was very sick and my head was foggy to begin with. And obviously everyone was very downtrodden. And I was the only damn reporter, George, in the press conference afterward. So I had to ask every question to a very upset Ryan Odom and to some very sad players. I want to say maybe it was Jason Nelson and Zeb Jackson, who were just class acts after that game, answering my questions and being kind about it when they were obviously pretty beat up. But that was that was the hardest press conference of my life. I was going through it there, man. But we could hear them in the tunnel outside the media room. As the Norfolk State players were coming by, I don't know who said this, but we heard very audibly, they got all this money and they still lost to us. Something like that. And so I don't know who that was. I don't know if it was Thomas that said that. I have no way of knowing that. But it would obviously be pretty funny to see, you know, for a Norfolk State team that came into the Siegel Center and won and was saying stuff like that. So then at the end of the year, your best player transfers to VCU. It'd be a good get, though. Much respect for his game, man. That kid was tough. It would be fun to see him in black and gold. It seems like it would be a good fit. The links have dried up a little bit in recent days, right? I'm not seeing VCU on these lists like we were initially. And that, coupled with the fact that we haven't seen anyone come out and say I'm entering the portal yet, makes me think that there might be a pretty big collective we're coming back building up here with a big portion of this roster that has decided to stay together. Maybe that's naive. Like you said, I mean, the delay is certainly in part due to the fact that this team was playing basketball so late into the year. 38 games, by the way. I see 24 and 14, and I go, holy that's a lot of basketball games, man. They played a ton. And so, but I don't know. I think that every day that we don't hear something, I believe more that a lot of this core is coming back.
Well, that would be great news. You mentioned this to me off air, so let's do it now, because one of the players that everybody's worried about is going to transfer is somebody we've talked a lot about here on this show tonight, and that is Fats Phillips. Why don't you relay to our audience the thing that you saw over the weekend? Because I did not see this, because admittedly, I do watch a lot of college basketball this time of year, but in terms of VCU stuff, I'll unplug a little bit because I'm also watching a lot of horse racing this time of year because that's one of my many interests that I have. So what's going on with Fats? Is he sticking around? Please tell me he's sticking around, because I want him to stick around desperately.
So we could do some mental gymnastics, and people have been doing some mental gymnastics with this Instagram post here. It's from Sunday. It's a Fats Phillips post. The caption is "Forever 5." With a burning heart. His number is 5. The song is "Sorries and Ferraris" by Polo G, which I'm not quite familiar with, but I think the lyrics go, "First come the sorries and then the Ferraris." And so some people were nervous that that's like Fats saying, like, I'm upgrading and I'm sorry, like, I love you guys, but like, I'm gonna go get my Ferraris or something like that. Cause, you know, I don't know. The first like few pictures are just him in a VCU uniform, different shots from the season. It's the last two that are particularly intriguing. It's one's in black and white. It's his jersey hanging up in the locker room. It says Alphonso Billups III, Richmond, Virginia, above it. And then the last one is a Stephon Diggs tweet from March 15th. Stephon Diggs, who has since gone to the Houston Texans.
That's right.
And it says, "Ready for whatever." is the Stephon Diggs tweet. It's a screenshot of that. Yeah. So that makes you think that he might be leaving is the worry there, because Stephon Diggs already left. And then you could get into the gymnastics too with the comments. Jason Nelson commented a black heart. Zeb Jackson commented just a dude walking, and that's it. There's nothing else in it. I have no idea what that is. Is that you're walking out on us? I have no idea what that is. Nick Kern with a couple of hearts with the bandages over it. Michael Bell, my effing twin. So that seems to be some love. Ace Baldwin.
I miss Nick Kern so much. I'm sorry. I miss Nick Kern so much.
Me too. I like Nick. Great kid. Penn
State this year. And,
Ace Baldwin, Hey Five. I don't know, man. There's a lot going on there, and who's commenting and what they're saying in the post. But obviously, I think the difficult part is the Stephon Diggs tweet at the end.
Well, and again, remember the contrast. Last year, Mike Rhodes leaves, and almost immediately, and I mean it was not more than a day or two, Alphonso Billups is like, I am planting my flag in this spot right here in Richmond, Virginia. I'm going nowhere. And we're like, we love you. All of us, we love you. That put Alphonso Billups, if he wasn't already in the hearts of a lot of VCU fans, he was certainly in mine after that. I'll speak for myself here. Like, I love you, and I will love you forever just for saying that. Mm-hmm. And you and I have had this discussion over other platforms. There are going to be some ructions if he transfers, because 24 wins is great. That NIT run is great. You know, getting to the conference final after everything they went through is great. Fats Billups transferring would spend a lot of that positive capital that Ryan Odom has. It would be a lot of it would be gone. There are going to be a lot of upset people, and spoiler alert, my hands up, I'm one of them.
Me too. I've covered Fats since high school at Verina. He's been outstanding to cover. He's an outstanding kid. You talked to him too, right? When we were in Orlando, and I remember after that Penn State game, he's incredibly soft-spoken. Yes. I mean, it would have been easy after that game with all the emotions charged into it to be a little more demonstrative and fire. Yeah. Yes, exactly, to beat the chest a little bit there, and he did not. And I don't know what that post means. To me, at the end of the day, maybe it just means he's still figuring it out, and he's, you know, proud of what was accomplished this season and everything. But yes, part of the free Fats calls during the season, it wasn't just, you know, he can help our productivity now. It's you've got to play him so he doesn't leave, you know. And exactly, now in hindsight, had the production in the NIT, if he leaves, then that's absolutely, people are going to be screaming and saying, Ryan, what the hell? You know, you should have played him more and tried to hang on to this kid, at least play him enough, you know. And I'm sure Ryan was saying stuff to this effect, but throughout the season, you're part of our future. You know, you're part of the fabric of this program. You're a Richmond native. You stayed through the coaching transition. Like, you're part of the cultural fabric holding VCU together right now. I'm sure stuff like that has been said to Fats, but if he goes, then people are going to be irate, you know, over there wasn't enough effort put forth during the season to get him out there. Oh man, when he made shots at the Siegel Center, when he had moments this year, it was some of the most electric moments of the year in there, right? And Jason, I think the same is true for him. Bless Rose, he probably didn't do enough throughout the year for that to be said. You know, I can't think of really any moments.
It was electric in Orlando. Electric in Orlando when it happened. Darn it.
People loved, and that was so much. I did the whole story in the offseason, right, about this big homecoming and everything, and all these guys are going to be together, and the relationships among that group are obviously strong. People were so excited to see them in a VCU uniform, and Fats, I think the consensus is obviously, and from a recruiting standpoint too, that he's got the highest ceiling of those guys, right? And so people want so much to see him be a star, you know, in the black and gold, and especially in this age of college basketball too, right? When 4-5 year guys are so rare to stick with a program. Maybe this is naive, but I think, you know, people have dreams of this, like Fats Billups here his whole career, all A-10, you know, A-10 championship, NCAA tournament run. And here's this Richmond kid who's at the heart of it. That'd be so cool. Everyone would be so excited about that. And I think that it, regardless of how it plays out, you know, going forward, if anything diverts from that path, people are going to be heartbroken, you know, because it's just, there's so much hope for what could be such an inspirational gravitational narrative around Fats that you know, it's almost like, even if Ryan saw it as a schematic detriment to have him in there, people are almost like, we don't care. Like, let him make mistakes. Like, let him grow. Exactly. Like, guilty. Get him out there, because the ceiling is too, like, we need to keep him here. Like, we want this kid to be a hometown hero so much. And then the ceiling is so high that let him make mistakes. Let him be out there and grow, and give him the minutes, and let the defensive breakdowns and the technicals happen so we can get him out of his system and learn, you know? And yeah, I mean, people are going to be, we're all going to be, it's going to be a firestorm if he goes, man. Especially, you know, that last year, the image with him on above the James River, and this is my city, and it's a great day to be a Ram and everything.
Oh my God.
You can't plant that flag, and then he leaves a year later. I mean, people are going to be heartbroken, man. So, yes, I'm with you. I mean, do we want to move on to the rest of the roster? He's the first.
I want to move on to one other thing before we go, because it's weird to say that this almost doesn't matter these days, but with the portal, recruiting freshmen to your program as strange as it sounds is almost minimized. But Brandon Jennings from St. Christopher's is coming, and lots of people, quite rightly, are excited about that. And I'm one of those people. I can't wait to dig into him and find out more about him as we do the new player series. But here's my question. Are there any other freshmen that are going to be coming or not?
I don't believe so. Okay. I don't believe so. I think Brandon is the only one, right? Kwani and Bairstow's roster spots are open. Joe Bamisile's coming back. And I think that's kind of all we know for sure right now. Everything else is up in the air, right? So that's two roster spots open
Two scholarships short, I think.
Yes, yeah. Everything that happened with Jacob Patrick.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a note to throw out there, by the way. I'd love to see this team get a pure shooter. Get a pure catch and shoot guy.
Well, that was going to be my next question: is if you had a grocery shopping list, what's how do you rank it?
Give me Gibson Jimerson. I mean, if this is Christmas and I'm giving Santa my list, right? Then that's another rich area.
A pure shooter, you think is the most important thing?
No, I wouldn't say the most important thing. That's the thing that I think they were missing this year that I wanted this roster to have, and so I'd love to see them go out and get that. Just a guy that can, you know, shoot with a bunch of volume, operate and run off of off-ball screens and hammer screens and chin screens and pin down screens and just let him, you know, other guys be distributors for him, because they didn't have that this year and I thought they needed that. But no, the most important thing is a big that can play with their back to the basket. That is absolutely the most important thing. Toby and Firm did a lot of growing this year, enough for VCU fans, I think, to be really excited about their future. I don't know if either of those guys are ever just going to be a pure throw it into the post and let them go to work guy. You know, Toby's a rim runner. Toby's athleticism is amazing. He's one of the most fun players to watch that I've ever covered. VCU absolutely needs to hold on to him, because I think if he wanted to step up, he probably did enough this year that he could. Firm kind of might be in that sweet spot where, like, he did enough that you're excited about his future, but I'm not sure Power Fives are going to be clamoring for him in the portal. Right, I love both of those kids from a developmental standpoint. They were efficient around the rim all year, operated really well in the two-man game, good understanding in the pick and roll. Toby's dunks are awesome. You know, they're some of the coolest moments nationally, even. I mean, people, you know, commentators who haven't seen VCU wax poetic over seeing Toby the Wall's vertical. That was on the VCU bingo card all year, right? Was where the announcer is going to talk about Toby's vertical. And then Firm's activity. He was really good in the NIT. Yes, I thought Firm really, if he could just get a little more confidence with ball security around the rim, right? Had too many moments where
he got the bounce passes
dislodged in traffic for him.
And he needs to get stronger. He has got to hit the weights big time and get stronger, because there were several instances of him not hanging on to rebounds, as for instance, or passes, because he just simply wasn't strong enough and he was out-muscled for the ball. But to me, in terms of throwing into the post and score, Furman has started to take some steps on that journey to being that kind of player.
He needs to be more assertive in that regard, right? There were some moments where he would get the ball in good spots in the post and he'd immediately kick out, you know, and he wouldn't even turn and look at the rim. And I think that's just youth and him kind of being too unselfish. I want him to be more selfish, down there and a little more assertive and look for his shot in the post. But that's, you know, I see freaking NC State, man. And I see them just get everyone clear out. Get DJ Burns, here's your side of the floor. Everyone else F off and let them go to work. And I'm like, that is what VCU didn't have, right? Yeah. You didn't have a guy that, I mean, you asked Shulga and Jackson and Bamisil to create off the dribble so much, and Bairstow, right? And for that to be how this offense was initiated, and there was so much weight on those guys' shoulders for so much of the year to create from an offensive standpoint for other guys, that you need a big that can play with their back to the basket, that you can clear out one side of the floor, you can throw it to them in the post, and they can hit a turnaround hook, or they can hit a spin, you know, or they can get to their shot. I don't think it's going to happen, but Josh Cohen, that would be like example A of like the type.
He's already gone to Arkansas, hasn't he?
Is he already transferred?
He's changing his mind because Musselman's left.
That's the type of guy that I think VCU would love to go get, a pure back to the basket. And they struggled against those type of guys too, right? That's from the defensive side too, is they need a guy who can guard those true fives. You know, Chad Benning killed them this year. That guy's obviously a load. There were Cohen killed them this year. They really struggled against true back to the basket centers. And so I think that's what they need to go get more than anything, is a guy that they can throw it into in the post, operate the offense through to take some pressure off of the guards on the perimeter from a creativity standpoint, and a guy who can guard the same type of player on the other end.
Anybody else on the roster you want to talk about before we get on out of here and finish up?
I really want Zeb to come back, man. Just a great kid, been an ambassador for this program. Yeah. And he's already, like, he started at Michigan, right? So he's already like went from a Power Five where he wasn't getting the playing time that he wanted developmentally, and then come down to VCU and been productive, especially this past year. And so I'd just be sad to see, you know, him go back and try again. And, you know, I don't know how it would play out for him. I mean, he showed some great things developmentally this year. Maybe he gets a lot of NIL money, and, you know, I'd never fault him for taking that opportunity. But for a kid that has just become so beloved in the VCU fan base for his commitment to a program that he transferred into in the coaching transition, would love to see him stay. Toby, like I mentioned, I think he did enough and turned enough heads that there's going to be, if he were to enter the portal, you know, I'm sure there's NIL money out there for him significantly. He's a guy that you could market really effectively, right? And so I think that, although that he's an international player, right? So I don't know if the rules in that are finicky. I'm not sure how much NIL money he can get, or if he can even get any, and what school, and the international rules are weird. I should know that, but that might help BCU, the fact that he's an international player, and so he's not, you know, eligible for the same NIL that the other guys are. If Shulga comes back, then everything else falls into place, I think. If Shulga comes back, then nothing else matters. Like, everyone else can leave if they want. If Max Shulga says he's coming back, then this is going to be a really desirable destination for transfers. And if Shulga's back, then Odom's got his guy to build around. He's got a first-team all-conference guard that I think would be one of the favorites, if not the favorite, for A-10 Player of the Year going into next season if he's back at VCU, right? And so if Shulga comes back, then this team could be really, really good next year. I think he, like you said, he's going to test the NBA draft waters, as he should, with everything that he showed this year. But another guy that's just been easy to root for, right? With everything that Max has gone through with his family back in Ukraine, man. I mean, I think the BCU fan base really grew to love that kid. And so would love to see him come back and finish things out. He's got 1200 West Broad Street, right? The address of the Siegel Center tattooed on his calf. You know, love to see him just finish things off at a program that he's come to love. And he followed Ryan. And Ryan obviously means a lot to him. I know some people have thrown out the idea of Sean Bairstow being a graduate assistant. I don't know if that's a realistic thing, but Sean and Max are obviously really close, and them sticking around. I don't know. I'm rambling now, but I think that, again, the fact that we haven't seen anyone enter the portal yet, every day I think we get nearer and nearer to there being a collective decision that we want to keep the band together. And I also think there's perhaps just maybe an aversion to change. I would like to think, maybe that's naive, but with everything that this program went through last year and the coaching transition and all the new pieces and getting settled, I mean, I'm sure Ryan is desperate for some stability. And I imagine some of those kids are like, do I really want to go through all this again? do I really want to, you know, change Diggs and make the big adjustment, have a new coach and a new offense, and what, just bring the band back, and this team could be so good next year. And so I think maybe it's naive, but every day that we don't hear news, I think we get closer and closer to, you know, it being Brandon Jennings is coming in and most of this team is coming back, and you've got a couple roster spots to fill.
Well, let me say this for Max Shulga. Anybody within the sound of my voice who knows somebody who knows how to make authentic pierogies, whether they are my whether they might be my Polish ancestral cousins or whatever, or somebody else, let's get somebody down there to Richmond and make some borscht and some pierogies for our man Max.
Did you see he got some? I think the Jewish Community Center.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, they did a really awesome thing. I think some people with Ukrainian roots there got him some good borscht.
He needs one of my Calabash Polish cousins to do that, because we know how to make some good pierogies. That's the big Christmas Eve dinner is fish and pierogies with no meat and borscht and all that kind of stuff. So we can make Max feel at home. We just need some Polish folks to do me a solid on that for their. Since that's my heritage as well.
Invite me too, man. That sounds delicious.
The borscht isn't, but the rest of it is. Believe me. The borscht is an acquired taste, one I have not acquired at this point. But I love the rest of it. So that's a very positive word to end out on, because I do think that all this upheaval, you think about all the upheaval and everything we've talked about, and this team was right there to win an Atlantic 10 conference championship, be in the tournament, and they could have won games in the tournament. Duquesne did it. VCU could have done it. They got two wins on the road in the NIT. They got to an NIT quarterfinal, which is only the third time they've ever done that. And it's only the fourth time they've won multiple, fifth time in the history of the school that they've won multiple games in a postseason tournament, i.e. not the conference tournament, the one after the conference tournament. There is a platform here to have not just a successful season next year, an amazing season next year, because whatever happens, Ryan Odom can't possibly, hopefully, and his staff not face the kind of challenges they faced this year, because it really was ludicrous, some of the things that they had to go through and putting this team together and the scheduling issues that they had. You know, I would fully expect next year that we'll play true road games in the non-conference season. I hope it's multiple. And I fully expect one of them will be a Power 5 game, too.
I think UVA is going to happen. I don't know if it's immediately this season. I know there was mutual interest there last year, and the dates just didn't match up. Yeah. I think with exams there in that block in December. But Ryan, obviously, with UVA roots, his dad was an assistant there. He spent some of his childhood in Charlottesville. I think Ryan and Tony both want that game to happen. It's going to happen soon.
Crossing my fingers for that, because that would be great. So, again, I feel like next year could be really awesome, because this year was pretty good, and this year had a lot of challenges for this program, and they've navigated all of them to end up with 24 wins, you know, at a conference final and an NIT quarterfinal. That's pretty good. So that's sort of the thought I want to end on, but any final thoughts you want to share before we get to the end of the show?
I've rambled a lot here, and I'm sure you need to cut things off. So let me know if we need to here. But I've had a hypothetical a poke the bear question that I've been throwing around to people that I really wanted to have a debate with John O'Connor, and he shot it down. Who had a better season, VCU or Richmond?
Oh gosh. Well,
it's interesting, isn't it?
And the thing is, I'm going to value a regular season championship really highly, because those matter. And maybe that's the bias of VCU shared or won a lot of those and not won a lot of tournament titles.
But a regular season championship.
Well,
it cut down nets too.
Way to go cursing yourself, Richmond. That was awesome. You bunch of schmoes.
Because you won more games than Richmond did?
I did.
VCU ended up definitively higher in the net and higher in adjusted efficiency in pretty much any metric that you want to look at.
They did.
VCU probably on the balance of the two games. I know they split two, but they pushed them to the limit at Robbins, right? And then won by – did it end up at double digits at Siegel Center? Was it 60?
It was double digits at Siegel Center. the Robinson, the game at the Robin Center.
And with how Richmond's season ended, with getting killed by Texas.
That's the tough thing is that I would certainly take Richmond's regular season over ours. I thought their non-conference was better than what people realized. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they shared the conference title, got the number one seed. Certainly VCU's post-regular season was far better. But, again, that's a smaller sample. That's four, seven games versus one or two because they did get in the NIT and they lost.
It's a fun question. Yeah.
But JOC, God love him. I can see why he wanted no part of that.
Oh, you can see how his reaction to that was. First of all, he got very up in arms about me even saying it was a co-regular season championship.
Oh, John.
He was like, they beat Loyola. They were the one seed. They're the champs.
That former Richmond Spider middle infielder, God love him. I miss working with that man. He's the best.
I love him to death.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, no, and I can understand why he wants no part of that question. Because there are some uncomfortable answers there.
And
of course, Richmond didn't have to deal with a tenth of the mess that VCU had to deal with. Mm-hmm. So if you're grading on a curve, you'd say VCU.
And you know what John was candid about too is VCU and Richmond had different expectations. They do relative to the standards of the programs, right? And so and that's, you know, that's kind of a backhanded argument, right, from a Richmond perspective to say, oh, we have lower expectations. But relative to, you know, they were picked to finish 11th and VCU was picked to finish second.
Yeah.
Right. So relative to expectations, Richmond obviously had the better season.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. But again, you can grade on a curve there.
Yes, you can. It's a fascinating discussion.
Yes. Well, as I expected, this was really great. Zach Joaquin, thank you so much for coming on. And honestly, I'm going to say a little prayer for you because now that I know what your circumstance is, you need it. That's obvious.
George, you're the best. Two news and notes things I want to throw in. Dennis Parker Jr. has been cleared to play. He's a John Marshall alum, All-Metro Player of the Year. He's an NC State player. He's been sick the last 10 games. That news just broke before we came on here. He's going to play or be eligible for NC State this weekend. So he might get some minutes in the Final Four. He was part of their rotation. Richmond kid. So everyone will be rooting for him. It'd be awesome to see him on the floor there in Arizona. And then I had a really cool interview this morning for a story that's going to come out tomorrow with Porter Rhodes, who is Mike Rhodes' daughter. Who's a lacrosse player at St. Catharines and is really good and has stayed behind and still lives in Richmond with their mom, Jody, and grew up here. You know, Mike was obviously the coach at Randolph-Macon for a long time and then an assistant at VCU. So she thinks of Richmond as home. And so I'll throw out a plug for that. Go to richmond.com and read that story. Had a great interview with her talking about what Richmond means to her family, how difficult it was to deal with the coaching transition. You know, and she's committed to go play lacrosse at Penn State. So she's a hell of a player. That was a really cool interview. Go check that out. Great family. They're great people.
See, I didn't even have to ask for the shameless self-promotion. There
it is. I went for it.
Also follow him on Twitter at Zach Joaquin, ZachJoaChim. Yes, do that as well. And of course, as always, in spite of everything that's being thrown at him, and again, maybe not as challenging as Ryan Odom's season, but he's having boulders and different things thrown at him as well. He will still be providing you in the Richmond Times-Dispatch with the best VCU coverage possible as we get ready for the portaling and we are going to see what happens. Because, of course, by the time this comes out, we may have got people in the portal. Hopefully not, but we'll see. But I want to thank everybody for listening. As always, we will be keeping our eye on the portal. We may be having Zach back on at some point with all this. And of course, as we find out who's coming in, new player profiles will be coming out and all that sort of thing. That is Rams Rewind for this week. This was a very long episode, but there was a lot to talk about with this VCU season, a lot of meat on the bone that had to be chewed on, and we chewed on it very well. Zach, thank you very much. Everybody out there in podcast land, thank you, and we'll talk to you next time.
To submit a question for George to answer in an upcoming episode or to inquire about sponsorship opportunities for this podcast, please email ramsrewind@gmail.com. Thanks for listening to this episode of Rams Rewind.